world-renowned artist and creator Romero Brito on the art world's emergence post-pandemic. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Brito is the most licensed artist on the planet. He has redefined pop art with his vibrant colors and bold styles. He's going to be speaking at the Economic Summit this week in Miami, and we'll talk to him about his influences, how he developed his style, and his new studio. Also, Florida is on the verge of raising the smoking age from 18 to 21, but the law would take control from local governments and put it in the hands of the state. Finally,
they face systematic, struggle every single day.
We'll meet the Palm Beach County Teacher of the Year. All of that today on Sundial, after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Anyone who spent time in South Florida will recognize a Brito artwork when they see one. His paintings and sculptures are iconic. At museums, to airports, to schools, his explosive bright colors and cubist-inspired configurations are seen anywhere and everywhere. And that's intentional. Romero Brito is the most licensed artist in history. His partnerships with Coca-Cola, Disney, and Mattel mean generations of children have grown up playing with Brito-inspired gadgets and toys. He'll be speaking this week at the Miami-Dade Chamber of Commerce Economic Summit about the intersection of art and business. But he joins us now here on Sundial. Romero, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, pleasure. Happy to be here with you. Nice to hear your voice.
So, Romero, as an artist, I'm wondering, how do you see your role in the recovery of this community that's been devastated by the virus?
Well, my hope is that always, even before, the pandemic, my hope was always that, I could create images of hope and happiness to bring, to people's, lives, a smile and good feeling in their hearts. And I understand that, with the pandemic, people spend more time at home and have more time to reflect about their lives, about what they're doing, their families and the future. And of course, it's so important to be surrounded by things that can remind you that there's hope, that there is and be more positive, like images of positivism, a color that, painting that can have colors that can make you feel, this vibration of that you don't usually see when you see black and white. So that's, my hope. And then I'm so glad that, I was doing this before. It was not like something last minute. I've been painting since I was a kid, and I always had this feeling about sharing my work with everyone. And I did create like a coloring book during the pandemic, which was, it went so well. Millions of people could enjoy their families when they were at home. And it was really nice in doing that. It was a good feeling doing that, even though that was kind of a little bit, I would say scary, but not a good feeling to be, all the time, by yourself. I only had one person, which was the CEO coming, weeks after weeks, to the studio with me, Lucas. But, and then people start coming, back.
I wonder, besides the coloring book, what else were you doing during this time? How did you deal with the pandemic?
Painting. I was coming to the studio every day, and I was painting, and I was creating, beautiful paintings. And I did so much art, basically, organizing myself. We moved to a new building, and as well, there was a lot. I mean, during the whole pandemic, I was super busy. And, things that I couldn't do because my schedule was so hectic, my travel schedule was like going to a trip, let's say, to Europe for one exhibition, fly back, or go to Europe, go to Asia, and come back like in the same week. Going to Korea for one exhibition, I had to fly right back. Yeah. Things like that. It was really like crazy schedule. And so finally I was, having a routine, going every day. I'm back to the studio, and I was able to start and finish my work, which before I couldn't do that because it was like I started, but I couldn't finish that same week or the same day or whatever, the same month, because there was so much, And it's funny because now I'm working, in pieces that I started in 2014 that I couldn't finish because of my schedule. And I'm finishing pieces that I started in 2014. How crazy is that? 7 years ago.
Well, yeah. Sometimes that's, I guess that's how it works out. You know, I mean, part of this, you know, talking about the return of the economy here in South Florida, I wondered, as an artist, for you, what do you think happened? How was the art world in Miami impacted by this pandemic? Considering, for example, we didn't even have Art Week. We didn't have Art Basel.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, because I'm an artist, but I always dreamt, you know, sharing my work with people. And I did so many things that other artists, they don't do. And I think, you know, in the way, it's been so helpful to me as an artist, because, you know, imagine if you do a painting and the galleries there were all closed and people cannot come in there and they cannot enjoy and participate in what you're doing. It becomes like, I don't know the story because I haven't, you know, I haven't been talked to a lot of people in the arts because I've been like doing my thing, you know, but I can imagine a lot of people, you know, didn't do that great. But I think it's because, you know, the art is like, you do a painting and then there you go. So, and I do other things inside of the painting. So.
Well, I wanted to ask you a little bit about, you know, first your childhood, a little bit about, you know, how you started. You were born and raised in Brazil, and I'm wondering, what were your favorite memories as a child? I'm wondering how that impacted your art.
Well, actually, so many things, you know. I never thought, when I was a kid, I could never imagine that, what was happening, because when you're a kid, you don't know, you're just living, and you don't think about so far ahead. But sometimes I was thinking that one of the reasons that I like my art to be so like organized is because, you know, my mother, I grew up in a family, my mother had like 12 children, only 9 survived. And there was a lot of kids in my house, and there was my brothers had friends. So there was always my mother never wanted us to go to people's house, but that she would rather have other kids come to the house to play with us there, right? To be around the house. So it was really chaotic and it was very like a mess, right? So I always wanted to do my paintings so clean and so organized. And as I reflect on that, it was like I didn't have control of what was going on around me because it was very chaotic, but I could do that with my art. And I loved spending time after school under a guava tree. There was a table, and I have different memories of being there after my homework, and I used to be doing drawing the whole afternoon, so.
And yeah, how old were you when you started drawing? I mean, I'd read that you pretty much would draw on anything, any surface, anything.
I was 8, and I draw on everything. I used to do things on the wall of my mother's house and the paper. And I think it was very helpful as I grew older, because if you don't have money, you don't have a supply, you're not going to, I tell artists, don't wait until you're going to get marble or bronze or a whole process for you to create a sculpture. There's so many things you can create art, you know, like Louise Nelson. I'm sure you know about Louise Nelson, that she did amazing sculpture, that she used to pick up a piece of furniture in New York in the garbage, and she created pieces now that you see in the Museum of Modern Art. So you don't have to wait until you have the day that you're going to use canvas or incredible or the supplies so you can do art. You can do it today because there's so much already done there that people throw in the garbage, and you can just do it.
Yeah. Now, so my understanding, it was like the early 80s when you left, you went to Europe, you went to Paris to see the masters, to learn. And I'm wondering, what did you see while you were there, and who was the biggest influence on you?
Well, I went to so many museums. I was kind of a museum rat. I used to go to the museums, look at those art, and then I was like, imagine how it was at the time when the artist was standing in front of those canvases now in museums. And it was a very big impact on me. But I think the bigger impact is when I moved, you know, because I went back to Brazil. I wanted to be a diplomat and ambassador of Brazil. That was a huge dream. But when I went back to Brazil, I realized that I was so miserable with what I was doing, going to law school. And then I quit law school, and then I said, you know what, I'm going to go back to Europe. But before, I have a friend of mine that was studying here in U.S., Miami, Leonardo, and then I came to visit Leonardo, and I love Miami. and I stay here. But and then I started learning more about, you know, American artists, and I like very much. I love the work and how whimsical he was. Andy Warhol, Keith Haring, Roy Lichtenstein. You know, in particular, Roy Lichtenstein and Keith Haring. I love their work, and they had a huge influence in my art. But I like everything that's colorful, like Matisse and the colors of Picasso and Leger and, you know, Piet Mondrian, which I, and recently I did some paintings inspired on that, and that Toulouse-Lautrec, you know, I mean, so many artists are amazing there.
Yeah. And at that stage of your life, where were you in your development as an artist?
Oh my God, where I was. Well, I'm still in development of my work. So, but you know, I was, stage zero. And, I think I understand more about myself as a person and also about what I'm doing with my work. And, but you know, as an artist, it's not, you know, you only over when you die, when you over basically, and that's it. You know, then there's a whole new journey of, for the body of work that an artist creates. So, but I was in a learning process. I mean, I don't know if you read somewhere there, but I never went to art school. So it was just a learning process, you know, the whole thing about, it's good because in a way that I had a chance to not have people telling me, oh, do this way, do that way, do this way. Because a lot of times it does happen and you end up having teachers that can destroy a career of an artist. You know, people can really give up about something because, the academia, you know, it's just, you know, sometimes has a way of teaching. But, you know, I never went to art school.
I'm talking with iconic artist and creator Romero Brito. He's now the most licensed artist in history with partnerships with major corporations around the world. Brito will be speaking at this week's Miami-Dade Chamber of Commerce about the intersection of art and commerce. And you can find more information about the free virtual event, because it is free and open to everybody, at our social media, WLRN Sundial. Romero, you arrived in Miami, I guess it was 88, 89, late 80s, right?
Yeah, early 80s.
Early 80s. Well, tell me, what was happening, I guess, in the art scene when you arrived? What did you see here?
Well, there was not an art scene here. There was I remember going to an exhibition of a place called Wet Paint Cafe. It was really nothing, you know, that I wanted. It was in a cafe on Lincoln Road. But Lincoln Road was I was scared actually to go all the way down to, you know, where was this exhibition. In a little cafe of these two artists that I met, you know, they were doing an exhibition of collage there. And I was mesmerized. And then as time went by, one day after so many things happened, I got this commission from Absolut Vodka, and my work was all the magazine that was selling my work. And I had already a studio after 5 years, you know, I had already a studio in Coconut Grove. And then I thought Miami Beach is happening, this renaissance. And I wanted to go to that. Gianni Versace is there. Everybody's talking about. So I was maybe I should try to go to Miami Beach, but not Ocean Drive. And then, Ocean Drive was where everything was happening. But then I thought, maybe I'm going to go and find, something that street that I went that was so wide. And it was Lincoln Road. And people thought it was totally crazy. When I got over there and I saw this building and it was all boarded, and I was let me call this man here. And it was Stanley Levine. And then I moved to Lincoln Road. But anyway, so the art scene was really not, it was non-existent. You know, of course there was people in Miami that they were collecting. There was a gallery that did beautiful shows in Bal Harbour, on the back of Bal Harbour shops. And it was a beautiful gallery there, but they closed, you know, and they did show, I think Andy Warhol, the woman did the show of Andy Warhol there. But it was really not what it is today, because now it's we are in the epicenter of the arts. We have the Oscars of the arts in America, in the world. You know, the Art Basel Miami is a very big deal. Mm-hmm. And of course that we definitely pray, myself as an artist, and I'm sure a lot of people in the arts, you know, they definitely, you know, hope that Art Basel would come back, you know, to Miami and would continue growing and bring so many people to the city.
Why Miami, though? You could have gone to New York or Los Angeles. like a lot of artists tend to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think Miami, because I felt comfortable here, and I have to say, a gallery owner once told me the best thing I've done was to stay in Miami because I grew with the city, and the city was happening. And so, you know, give an opportunity for me to, because when you go to a city that's so big, you can just be like swallowed by the whole thing, be lost totally, like a city like New York. And I think also the city is being very good to me all those years, all those people that I had met and I made friendship. I had incredible friends here, great relationship with people in the city here. And I just, you know, I love the mix. I mean, so many reasons, you know, reminds also about my city. I was born in Brazil, you know, sunshine year round, and the vibe is very up always, you know, there's always sunshine. It's beautiful. It's just, it's a great place to be. I travel the world, but I love it. I do have a house upstate New York, but I used to go there a lot when my son was very little, but now I, you know, he's, you know, older than me and taller than me. And so I don't go as much to New York. Still have the house there.
So you, I mean, your career, people could ask and debate about when you really took off, but I think it's kind of when Absolute Vodka came into your life. You met Michael Rowe, I believe is his name, is the founder, and he loved your work and he wanted to connect the two, your work and his product. And that, I mean, that's led you to working with Coca-Cola and Disney and Mattel and all these other big companies. For you, what's the fun part of designing art for a product?
Well, listen, when I do all this project that I did with corporations like Absolut Vodka, you know, started with Absolut Vodka and then so many other ones that fall, it's always a start with the painting. I never forgot about that. I'm an artist, and I think the reason that a lot of corporations, they, you know, I want to be enjoyed by, you know, I mean, one of the fun part of it is because I want to be enjoyed by millions of people, more and more people. I mean, what would be fun for you to do something that only you could have in your house and just one person? So the idea is multiply, you know, this image and let the world enjoy. And I think I was preparing my head since I was a kid because I liked sharing. I never had a problem about sharing things. You know, I feel this. And, you know, it's a very visceral feeling that I have of giving. You know, it's not like I know one day I'm going to die and I'm going to take nothing with me. So why not share with people? And if I'm an artist, I think it's a great feeling. You're an artist, you're a painter, you're a singer. You don't want to sing just for yourself in the bathroom. So I myself, you know, I've been very blessed that I was ready when I got the opportunity to do this ad campaign for Absolut Vodka to share my work with people, because a lot of time people in the arts are like, you know, this idea about, you know, being very exclusive. You can be special. You don't need to exclude people. You need to include people. You know, of course, you know, as an artist, you know, there's only so many. If you do an original painting, the painting becomes so valuable. You're going to be one person in the world to own that painting. But why not that image to be multiplied in other ways that other people can see it? Let's say if you go to the Louvre Museum, you see the Mona Lisa. But I mean, how sad it would be for somebody in the extreme of Brazil or in Africa or Australia or somewhere in the world that they don't have access to go to Paris to see the Mona Lisa at the Louvre Museum.
That's, you know what? That's an interesting point. So, I mean, you have, for example, I mean, with art, as you said, you know, you'll have one piece and that piece becomes extremely valuable because it's rare and, you know, everybody wants to see it. But you, I mean, you're the artist, like your work is everywhere. Like everybody has seen your work probably at some point somewhere, and whether they knew it or not. And I'm wondering, as an artist, do you ever get worried that you go so mainstream, so commercial, that maybe that reduces the value and the meaning?
Yeah, but you have to understand one thing, is that the people in the arts that, you know, are collecting super expensive art, they know the difference between a postcard and a canvas, a painting. I mean, let's say, again, if you go to the Louvre Museum and you go see the Mona Lisa there, you know, protected by bulletproof glass, and then you're going to go downstairs somewhere and you see the store and you buy, like, a postcard. You know that there's a postcard of an image and there is the Mona Lisa, the painting there. You know, that's the original. It's like seeing a real person and see the person on the TV. You know, it's different. I mean, I think what does happen is that, you know, unfortunately, you know, people, a lot of time people are like thinking about, let's say, in arts, comparing art to, you know, fashion, or art with like a diamond, or art with status symbol of a person that people think, well, you know, if you are in the eyes of everybody, you know, you cannot be in the eyes of God or in the eyes of somebody very special. You understand? So you can't go to that party, because if you go to that party, everybody's going to think that you're like a nobody, because everybody goes there, because they're for the world, the masses. But, you know, I think it's totally fine for the masses to enjoy and appreciate art. And I think we are in a world right now of multiplicity. I mean, everybody are able now to enjoy so many things that before you couldn't, because you did not have access to information. And now we have more access. So why not people to have access to an image? And if that image could be in different form, I think it's a very, you know, that commercial is not bad. To be commercial is good, is very good, you know. Yeah. It means it sells, you know. Like, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, very successful. It would be bad about the time of work. But, you know, the brand Grito out there is very special, and people appreciate that, and they want to have that in their house as an original painting. You know, since 1889, I've been doing this for quite a long time. So, and you see, like, companies, you know, I'm an artist, but I do have a company too. I'm very organized, and I've been very blessed to have been an incredible team of people. And throughout the years, so many people that work, you know, in this organization, and, you know, have about 100 people that works, you know, around there. So it's a lot. And people around the world, they are like benefiting from the success of Romero Grito. I mean, how many companies that have done project with me, and they benefit from this and this, you know, because of my art, you know?
Yeah. I wanted to ask you a little bit about, as we move forward, things here in the United States starting to get back to normal, I guess you could say. In Miami, things are opening up again. People are going out, you know, and trying to rebuild their lives. You know, but you've seen the coronavirus explode back in your homeland, in Brazil, and it's been really bad over there. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro has been criticized for his response in the way he handled the virus. You had supported Bolsonaro in the past, and you welcomed him to Miami, but I'm wondering, how do you feel about the way he's handled it and how Brazil has handled the pandemic?
You know, I mean, I would rather not discuss politics, because one thing is what people talk about what it is, and the other one is the reality of what it is, you know what I mean? So as you know, as a journalist, there's so many times that it's blown out of proportion, and I think maybe better that I don't say it more. So
do you still talk to, I mean, family, friends back over there? I'm just wondering how you know, how are they doing? How's everybody over there?
Can you ask me again?
Yeah, no, I'm wondering, like, how often you talk with family and friends in Brazil. Just, I'm wondering how people are doing. What's the, you know, how's with the pandemic, how's everybody hanging in there?
Listen, you know, I don't think that even here in America, you know, this spirit, you know, I mean, we have the state of Florida is more open than many other states. You know, things can, but it's still not as it was normal. You know what I mean? I'm now going back to a country that has all the challenges. You know what I mean? I mean, Brazil is a rich country, but not as rich as America, you know, and, you know, there's so much that, you know, when the impact of anything like that magnitude hits the place, it's like, it can be more challenging for a country like, you know, Africa or South America, or, you know, even here in the U.S. So, I mean, I do hope that, you know, we get out of these as soon as possible. And you know, and I'm very blessed to be here in the U.S. And be able to, you know, and go through this historic moment.
Let me finish with this. You have, coming back here to Miami, you have Rito Central, your new studio. And it is huge, 60,000 square feet. That's a big art studio.
Yes, it's very big, and we need more space because we're like, you know, it's called Guido Palace. and it's so beautiful, and I want to invite you to come. And we had the first guest, and here was Andrea Bocelli, that he came with his wife, Veronica, and Virginia, his daughter, his beautiful daughter. And it was very special.
How many people will you have working in there?
Oh, my God, it's too many.
I mean, 60,000 square feet, that's...
It's over 100 people work around my work, yeah.
And just for you as an artist, I mean, do you have still your own little space for you to work, or is it now expanded to this whole big studio?
Yeah, in the palace, I do have, you know, a studio inside the palace, which is beautiful. And next time, you know, I would definitely would love to invite you and come and visit. Well, are you based? Where are you based?
Well, we look forward to coming. We're just across the water. So, you know, we'll just have to come over there at some point. And I appreciate the...
Are you here in Florida?
Yeah, we're here in Miami, of course.
Okay, see you.
Romero Brito, you can find more details about this event coming up at the Miami-Dade Chamber of Commerce this week. The summit, again, is virtual and then free, open to everybody. Learn more about it on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Romero, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
No, my pleasure. Great to talk to you. And, you know, the event that's happening in the Chamber of Commerce is, you know, is really special. And I'm very, you know, grateful that they are sharing my work with everybody. And, you know, it's great to be a guest in the great Miami Chamber of Commerce, great organization for Miami, and it's so amazing. So.
Well, Romero, again, I much appreciated that you spent some time with us today. Take care.
Of course. Thank you.
And, of course, one of the other big names that will be at that event is Pitbull, the singer, so Mr. 305 himself. Well, still to come, Florida may soon raise the smoking age from 18 to 21. We're going to learn the details of a proposed tobacco law. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. A new bill awaiting the governor's signature would raise the smoking age in Florida from 18 to 21. It would also change the ability of local governments to regulate tobacco products. The bill's sponsor, Republican Jackie Toledo from the Tampa area, argues the legislation is necessary to slow the explosion of teen vaping. However, advocates from the American Cancer Society argue that the legislation would actually be harmful by taking away local power. We're going to hear both sides of this story. First, I want to bring in Representative Toledo. Thank you so much for being with us today. And I want to start with this. How could this legislation directly reduce youth smoking in Florida?
Well, it allows us to give law enforcement officers the enforcement ability. Right now, the only people that can really enforce it would be federal agents. And we need to make sure that there is consistency throughout the state. It's not a local problem. It's a statewide problem. And the epidemic is not going to go away. So we need to be able to enforce. We need to have compliance checks, which is what this bill will do, create some regulatory framework. So that the DBPR can start to make sure that all these vape shops are complying with the law.
And that, of course, you know, is where the opponents come in and say it is a state problem, but they're worried about that control, the local control. Why shouldn't local governments have that control over marketing and the restrictions of the products?
Well, in some areas, they do have local control, but the city next to them, they may not have any regulations. So then someone can go buy a vape product next door in a city that's within 1 mile away in, you know, whether you're talking about St. Pete or in Miami, where there's many cities. Tampa, we only have one city. But really, we've been doing this since 1985 with tobacco products, and it's been working. So I believe that state having the regulations and the restrictions would be best.
So a store owner could get in trouble for selling products to an underage person, but now teenagers could also, if they're caught, they can get in trouble. Why should teenagers also face citations?
It would be a civil citation. It's not going to go on the record. They will have to do a class, and they would also, you know, if they're caught within a certain amount of time, they could potentially have their driver's license revoked, but that's up to the discretion of the courts. This is obviously to deter those teenagers from getting the products and selling them, and also hold the vape shops accountable as well. And that's what the regulation will do.
And of course, one of the things that's been brought up, and I'm wondering your thoughts on this, the concern that Black or Hispanic students may be more likely targeted for these citations. What about that?
That is not something that we've seen. It's not prevalent in a minority area. This is happening regardless of whether you're white or Black or Hispanic. Just teenagers in general, there's about 50% that are self-reporting on having vaped and using these products. So that's what we want to try to combat.
What's the process right now of regulating stores, and how often companies are found violating these rules?
So in order to have a store, you just have to have a business permit. You don't have to dictate that it is a vape shop. So that's the problem. We have no idea how many vape shops there are. There's no way to pull their license. And this way, even though there's going to be a license requirement, we can revoke their license. We can fine them if there's a problem. Right now, there's no way to contact anyone to complain about a vape shop selling to minors. This will allow, you know, DBPR to manage them and revoke their licenses if they're found that they're not complying with the law.
How are you going to determine whether this law is effective? I mean, really effective in reducing teen smoking?
I mean, hopefully we'll start to see the decline of smoking and vaping. About in 2012, I think we had the lowest teens smoking, and then vape products started to come on the market. And now we have the highest in vaping that we've ever seen. And I think that because of the flavors, because of how it's marketed, and that's what we're going to try to reduce the access by increasing the age to 21 and start enforcing that age. I think we'll see a huge reduction.
So Governor DeSantis had vetoed a similar measure last year. I'm wondering why you're confident that this version is going to pass.
Last year, he had expressed concerns on the flavored ban, just because he said that would affect adults, too, that wanted to use flavors, which obviously attract children and teenagers and young adults. So I took that part out this year, and I think that he should be amenable to signing this bill into law.
Why is this issue of particular importance to you?
I have five children, and I've seen it firsthand with, you know, my kids, their peers, and just how they talk about vapes, how they really don't know what's in them. They think it's some of it is just vapor. It's flavors. It tastes good. You look cool. I think it's a big problem, and we actually don't know the health risk and the health impacts long term. So I think we're going to hear more about it, and it's going to cost every single one of us if we don't address it now.
Do you think that legislation is the way to go, or is it more education? I mean, we did have for many years the smoking anti-tobacco education, and we did see reduction in smoking. But do you think legislation is going to be enough?
I mean, it goes hand in hand. Enforcement is part of it, and education and legislation. I think you can't enforce it. You can't see the bad actors if we don't have a way to someone to complain about it, or someone to pull someone's license away. So that, I think, is going to go a long way, and it will reduce vaping.
And again, it is awaiting the governor's signature. Again, speaking with Republican State Representative Jackie Toledo, who represents parts of Hillsborough County. Florida's smoking age again being raised from 18 to 21. Toledo sponsored the legislation. Representative Toledo, thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it, too. Have a great day.
You too. And again, if you want to know more about this bill, you can find it on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Now, I want to bring in Gloria Garcia, lead ambassador for the American Cancer Society Action Network. Gloria, welcome to the program.
Yes. Hi, how are you?
Great to have you. Thank you so much. Gloria, why is it important for local municipalities to have control over advertising and penalties? Why not leave it up to the state?
Well, I think it's definitely very important to have it at a local level, because when we hear from parents, when we hear from the pediatricians, when we hear from the local folks who really go to their to the local government agencies, and they're the ones that really communicate better and let them know what the issues are in a particular county or in a particular area, they're definitely more effective at building programs or establishing programs that are effective in anything that can really help us during this huge fight. Now, we understand the urgency behind the situation at hand, but we really feel that having it at a local level is more effective. And why not allow a local level to have stricter standards? What, I mean, at this point, the state, we don't feel has anything in place that can accurately check on everything that's happening or will happen at a local level. And we've seen it with some counties, Alachua County, who's been very, very successful in maintaining local control.
What concerns do you have about young people facing citations, being caught with e-cigarettes?
Yes, this is very concerning to us, because really we don't know, you know, how it's going to take place and really how erratic it could be. Local law enforcement, if they, you know, suspect someone's using any kind of tobacco products, and these kids, they can target certain communities, the Latino community, the color community. And unfortunately, at hand is a problem with these fines, where it's really going to create another level of expense for these communities that are already probably, you know, struggling. And then on top of that, you're going to have license suspension, revocations. And at that point, they can't get to work. They can't get to school. It just creates a huge problem. But primarily, this legislation is a patchwork legislation. And honestly, to put this target on our kids and not to put it on the tobacco industry, who is responsible for this, is just something that we cannot support.
But instead just have the penalties on the vendors.
Correct. It should definitely be on the retailers and the vendors, because, you know, really, they're the ones that are bringing the product forward. They're the ones that should be monitored and fined accordingly, not the children, not the youth. I mean, at this point, we don't understand the purpose behind fining our youth.
And, you know, what we heard from the representative just a moment ago is the fact that, and her argument was that there isn't a good system for regulating vendors statewide. And that's a part of the reason for the bill, was to try to create a uniform system to make sure that they're all held accountable the same way. What about that?
Well, we don't see how it's going to be able to be regulated in a statewide system. And frankly, I think the local level is better equipped to deal with these situations. They're the ones that know the problems in their area. They're the ones that know what's happening. I mean, if you wanted an effective policy, you can establish something like a retail licensing system, similar to what we have in place with alcohol, where you have the penalties to hold these retailers accountable, the ones that sell these illegal products to our kids, that we would feel would be more effective.
What do you believe should be the strategy for reducing teen smoking, especially vaping now? What do you consider effective?
Well, we feel that the local community is better equipped to deal with their problems. We feel that definitely the retailers need to be held accountable. The industry needs to be held accountable. I mean, the amount, the way they're targeting these kids, and you've seen it, you've seen the ads, they're young, they're on social media, they're color coded, they're flavoring. All of this definitely is attractive to kids. I'm a mom, I have three teenagers myself, and it's a huge problem in our society, because it is the cool thing to do, especially these, you know, e-cigarettes. But the problem is that these kids are getting addicted.
You had a sister you lost to cancer, and that's kind of inspired your work, right?
That's correct. My sister unfortunately passed away in 2009 from breast cancer.
I brought this up with a representative, and I just wondered, what is the best way to reach young people? You know, is it legislation or is it more education? What really works to reach them and counter that movement that you talked about on social media, where they sell it as cool? They've always been selling tobacco as cool.
Absolutely. And this is just the same thing over and over again, unfortunately. I think we definitely need to educate our youth. Definitely. I believe that especially with this last year where we saw the importance of our respiratory health with the pandemic and everything beyond. We need to, you know, educate the children, show them what the effects are of these tobacco products. Just because it looks cool or it's a small product that, you know, that it's appealing and everyone can hold it and hide it, you know, in your pocket, it almost looks like a little device that they can handle anywhere. And, you know, the flavoring and all that, obviously, it definitely is something that they're attracting our youth in order to get them hooked. And these kids are, we're seeing the numbers. It's ridiculous how you have 1 in 4 high schoolers that are addicted to these products. And it's just unfortunate, but we need to educate our youth in order to have this turnaround, not penalize them in the form of citations and fines. We need to penalize the industry, not our kids.
Gloria Garcia, lead ambassador for the American Cancer Society Action Network. Gloria, thank you for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Have a good afternoon.
And you can read more about this story and our series, Tallahassee Takeover, looking at state versus local control of power, from cruising to policing and now to tobacco. Find it on our website, WLRN.org. Well, still to come, it's Teacher Appreciation Week. We're going to introduce you to Palm Beach County's Teacher of the Year. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, today marks the beginning of Teacher Appreciation Week, and we bring you the story of Palm Beach County's Teacher of the Year. She's been helping her students navigate literature on discrimination and human solidarity for the last 14 years. Toshimi Abijanaga is originally from Japan and teaches English, African-American history, Holocaust studies to predominantly Black students at Riviera Beach Preparatory and Achievement Academy. WLRN's Wilkin Brutus spoke with her earlier this year.
Our Palm Beach County Teacher of the Year is Toshimi Abijanaga. Thank you.
A lot of Americans go abroad to teach English in East Asia. I was one of them, actually. Several years ago, I spent 4 years teaching English in South Korea. You're originally from Japan. Why did you want to come to the States to teach English?
I got hired by Lynn University. I developed a lot of international study abroad program to bring Lynn University students to Japan and vice versa. So that's how I started. And then, you know, I met Alternative Ed, and that was, 15 years ago?
You're also one of the Palm Beach County School District's experts in Holocaust studies. And I know you combine English, Holocaust studies, and African-American history lessons for your predominantly Black students. Why did you start teaching about the Holocaust?
Well, my commitment was motivated by one student at the alternative school. And he brought the book. I don't know if you know the book called The Night by Elie Wiesel. And he said, I never finished this book, but this is the only book that I completed. So you got to read this one. And I was like, I didn't read that book at that time. And of course, I didn't know so much about the Holocaust. I knew it, but I didn't know the detail. And I was so impressed by his response. And I said, okay, then let's read it. And then I read it. It's just so powerful. Before I use the book, I have to learn how to teach that book and how to, you know, I have to know that what the Holocaust is, the history. So that's the start. And it was just so complex topic. So I had to keep going, many workshops. And then that was about 13, 14 years ago, because it's right after I got the job at the alternative school.
How do you make the lessons relatable to your students?
Most important part of my Holocaust is anti-Semitism. So it's basically systematic, you know, persecution. So, you know, and my students, they don't really aware, but, you know, when I break it down, and they will really understand because they face systematic, you know, struggle every single day. So I think I'm lucky that I can teach the Holocaust at this school, you know, because they know what the pain is.
And what kind of perspective do you think living in both Japan and the U.S. have given you on the subjects you teach?
I'm from a different country, and I can see very differently and from outside. And also, like, I would see what's happening as a minority. And then, you know, my language, too. I have a heavy accent. When I teach English, I always use the audio tape, not my accent. So that's, you know, technology is great. But I'm really telling the, you know, the students that you have to leave the community, you have to leave your city, you have to leave your state, you have to leave your country like you did. And then you will see that good parts and the bad parts. And always you can, you know, improve if you know both.
That was Palm Beach County Teacher of the Year, Toshimi Abijanaga. She teaches English, African American history, and Holocaust studies at Riviera Beach Preparatory and Achievement Academy. She spoke with WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter, Wilkin Brutus. To Toshimi and to all the teachers out there, just to let you know that you are so appreciated. Made me think about one of my favorite teachers going back all the way to high school, one of my English / creative writing teachers, Mr. Zucker. Mark Zucker, thank you so much. He's probably retired by now because that was a long time ago, but I just wanted to reach out and say to him, thank you so much for everything that you meant to my life. So to all teachers, raise a glass at Teacher Appreciation Week. By the way, you can stay in touch with us via text by joining our Sundial Text Club and tell us about your favorite teacher. Who was the teacher who had the biggest impact on your life? Send us your thoughts, your comments on shows like this one. You can find us on the text club by just typing hello to 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. Join us on the text club. So every time you hear a segment, you can always just text us and you can become part of the program. And just a reminder, by the way, for those of you who are part of the Sundial Book Club, we are reading, because I mentioned it last week, Gabriel Garcia's book of Women and Salts. If you don't know, if you're not part of the book club, just go to Facebook and search Sundial Book Club and ask to join. It's free. We'd love to have you. If you've already started reading the book, we'd love to know. What do you think? Tell us, is the book any good so far? I've been reading it. I like it, of course. Well, that's Sundial for this Monday, May 3rd. Sundial senior producer is Chris Remington. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Saria Reimer is our intern. Our engagement editor is Katie Leprey. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka. Our technical supervisor is Peter J. Maris. And of course, the theme music for the show is from the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Balo. Find them online, gobalo.com. Well, coming up tomorrow on the program, how vulnerable are nursing homes across South Florida to climate change? Well, back in 2017, if you recall, 12 seniors died at a nursing home in Hollywood following a power outage after Hurricane Irma. A new investigation from our reporters, Katie Switalski-Munoz and Jenny Stiletovich, explore the vulnerabilities facing Florida's elderly communities. Plus, researchers at Florida Atlantic University have captured the sounds of stingrays snacking. I wonder what they snack on. Their new underwater microphones called hydrophones could prove incredibly useful for underwater research in the years to come. We'll talk about all of that coming up tomorrow on the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, thank you so much for listening. And as I say, stay safe, be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.